Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajaris of Pragmatic Institute, and I am excited to introduce Jason Grigsby. Jason is the co-founder of Cloud4, a leading web design and development agency, the author of Progressive Web Apps, and the co-author of Head First Mobile Web. Welcome to Design Chats, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. So we would like to start by just giving the listeners like context and sort of the story of Jason. So tell us a little bit about your career journey and your passions.
Well, I think, throughout my life, from an early age, I kind of had this combination of interest in both computers and in publishing. So I think it was in the third or fourth grade that my parents saved up enough money to buy us a Commodore 64. Nice. And so I spent a little time there. And then I bought a modem for myself, a 300 baud modem, and was online. So that was like one track. But then in the other track, I also got involved in creating newsletters and using what at the time was called GeoPublish. It was like kind of like this Commodore specific version of PageMaker. And so I did a lot of that stuff, which meant that when I went to college, I majored in journalism, and was doing a lot of design and print publication work. And then the web specifically started taking off around that same time. And so I was building websites and thought that maybe I was going to go into sort of like a journalism field, but instead started working on the web and never really turned back.
So that's fascinating. So it was the kind of as the web came out and was journalism evolved a little bit from just writing the stories to also really thinking about how you present them. That's not true. Obviously, that happened in newspapers too. But it was a very different world when it started on the web.
Yeah. Well, so I was at the University of Oregon, and their journalism school has multiple emphasis. So, I thought going into the school that I would, be like Woodward and Bernstein or something of that nature. But in reality, I did not want to, nor do I believe in objectivity when it comes to writing. And so the idea that I could actually become a reporter no longer made as much sense. And so I started working a little bit in advertising and in public relations and things where, doing more design work was part of what you did. And so that's sort of dovetailed nicely with the print design stuff that I had done previously.
Nice. All right. So talk to us a little bit about Cloud4.
Yeah. So we started it, it'll be 15 years ago in October. The four founders, we had worked at a previous company together, and really we just saw an opportunity to go work on mobile. So it's 2007. At the time, there were 3.3 billion phones for 6.6 billion people on the planet. And nobody really understood, or very few people really understood, what that was going to mean in terms of the impact of mobile. The iPhone had come out, but was still very new. And we realized that the company we were at, we weren't going to have an opportunity to do any of that. So we started a small agency in order to have an opportunity to explore mobile. And that was about as far forward thinking as we got. We knew we wanted to play in the mobile space. And so we spent a little time. We helped build Obama's iPhone app in 2008, which was the first campaign application. After that, we contemplated doing more native development, but realized that our hearts were really on the web, and that basically everything that we had done in that application could have been done using web technology. So we decided to focus on the web. And from then, we've helped a lot of companies, create responsive versions of their sites or build progressive web apps. everything from like hospitals to, you know, Walmart. So large and small and everywhere in between.
For those of us, I think who have dealt a little bit with this, we know, we've seen how complicated responsiveness can be in terms of really making sure each experience is optimized for the different medium it's going to be on. And so you see it and you know it's complicated, but to some degree, it doesn't feel like it should be quite as complicated. What do you think is at the sort of the crux of the complexity and the challenges that people have when they're kind of working with responsive design?
I mean, well, first off, like it is tremendously complicated. Like I realize that we've become accustomed to it, which is a testament to how, you know, like how well we've done. But I mean, think about it. Like you're designing for a canvas for which you do not know the width nor the height. You're designing for input that is transient and unknowable. So the moment, just because you know that somebody used a mouse one moment doesn't mean they have access to it the next moment. And so you're designing for everything from trying to support touch-friendly targets in designs to supporting, you know, the pixel precision of a mouse. And you're trying to do that, you know, to devices that range from, you know, low-end Android devices with slow CPUs and limited network compatibility or capabilities to high-end desktop machines connected to gigabit connections. Like it is a wide range that we're trying to design for. And so consequently, I think it becomes hard to do. And I think it's particularly a lot of what I've been researching is how difficult that process is, you know, if you're not actually designing in the medium. So you're designing in, you know, static design tools like Illustrator or Sketch or something of that nature.
I think that's a really good reminder. It is complex and it is hard, and we've gotten a little spoiled because we see it work flawlessly. That sometimes, not flawlessly, we see it work very well in lots of places, that you start to take it for granted a little bit. And to your point, there's one of the challenges of responsive design is the lack of bumpers to some extent, right? The bumpers keep moving from you, and you kind of, when you're designing, you like some level of constraints to help, and there they just keep moving.
Yeah. To me, those are the fun challenges, but I recognize that there are days for many people and myself included where, my gosh, it would just be nice if we had a fixed canvas, if we had a fatter internet pipe, if we didn't have to deal with some of these things. You know, you take all those things in. I forgot to mention accessibility too, right? Like making sure that what you're designing is accessible. So like it's a lot of stuff to build a professional website, something that, you know, meets sort of what I consider the standards of the profession, like takes a decent amount of work.
And I also think it takes a partnership, right? Like I often think of it as responsive design, but it's really responsive design and development. Right? It is absolutely an interplay between your designers and your developers and really creating strong solutions there. And I know that's someplace that you spend a lot of time in your organization and a lot of time that you've thought about the roles of designers versus developers. And so another place I'd love to explore.
Yeah. So we're pretty fortunate at Cloud4 because our designers code. And it used to be 100% of our developers had gone to art school. It's no longer 100%, but they all have at least some design sense. So you can generally bank on them as they're doing the more complex implementations, which is where our developers end up usually being. If they see something that feels like bad UX, or sometimes even to the point of like, hey, this seems like trapped white space. What is this doing? I think there might be a better way to handle this. Like our developers are likely to identify that. But we work with a lot of client organizations, and you know, that's not always true, right? We've worked with phenomenal designers who don't code, and that's totally fine. Like their designs are exceptional, but because they design, say they design three sizes of, you know, like mobile, tablet, and desktop, right? Which is common practice, right? They design three static designs. there's just a lot left unsaid about that design. What happens in between those sizes? Mm-hmm. And when that design gets handed off to developers who, and through no fault of their own, aren't, don't have a design eye, haven't had any design training, haven't gone to art school, it's much more likely that the end result is a lesser version of that static design versus what I think actually should be true, which is that the web is a more capable medium. And so it actually should feel more alive. It should feel better on the web than it did on that static version. But instead, it feels like it breaks down, right? You know, our bank, one of our company's banks, you know, had a range of breakpoints where the entire layout busted. And it just happened to be in the range that was like half my screen. And so every time I was like trying to do accounting work and I was like splitting my screen up, mm-hmm. like their website was broken. And so finally I sent them a note. I was like, it's been a year. You haven't, do you even know this is going on? And that to me is like indicative of a process where designers, I mean, I can't say for certain, right? I wasn't in that process, but mm-hmm. I suspect what happened was designers had a set of, you know, fixed breakpoints that they were designing for. And nobody was designing sort of with the, my friend Stephen Hay refers it to it as like this process of like starting from a small screen, resizing your browser until something looks like crap, and then boom, that's when you need a breakpoint. Like that is like a fundamental thing for responsive design. But if you're designing with tools that are fixed width, like you can't really experience that. You can't participate in that process.
So you've mentioned that a couple of times, the tools that you use make a big difference. As we often say on this podcast, I am a product person and a marketing person. And so I have less depth here, which is one time that I find these conversations great. And they help me understand, you know, when I'm asking the wrong things of designers or I'm not arming them correctly, right? So talk about the tools then that are really helpful in responsive design. What are, if it's not static and I'm not using, you know, Adobe.
Well, yeah. So I think, so first off, I would say that I found myself in a weird spot sort of like focusing on tools because I don't, perhaps a bit like you, I'm more interested in the process generally than I am the specific tooling. But the reason why I've started looking at the tooling was because I came to the realization that the process that we prefer, which is, you know, designing in the browser, resizing browser and seeing where things break, prototyping behavior really quickly, and then making changes to that behavior or making changes to those designs based on what works and what doesn't, that when we worked with client organizations, they would be enamored by it while they were working with us, and then be unable to adopt it in their organizations after the fact.
Is that the, so in that case, is it, there's a tool aspect of it, but it's also because all your designers can code.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
But I don't, I guess I have higher hopes for tools. It's mm-hmm. been 12 years since Ethan coined the phrase responsive web design. And in the article, he described three techniques, you know, flexible images, fluid grids, and media queries. And there's not a single design tool right now out of the box that supports all three. Like 12 years later, and we don't even have a single tool that actually supports like a fundamental part of how we design for the web. And so that's what got me sort of looking at this problem. So, you know, we'll work with organizations, we'll help them with design systems. So we'll end up with, you know, these reusable components. And because our designers are working in code, as we work through a design process, the designs get faster and faster because we can reuse. So say we're working on an e-commerce site, we've already built the product tile. We spent a lot of time sweating the details on it, how it works across different screen sizes, depending on how much space is given to it. Like the tile itself is kind of its own system, right? It's got its own rules. We've done all that work to make sure that thing does what it needs to do. The next time we're doing a design and we need a product tile, whether it's for like a carousel or whether it's, you know, like a featured, like doesn't matter, right? Like that thing is baked and mm-hmm. doesn't matter what size we want to use it in the page. It's already taken care of. If you move to a design tool, there are very few of them that will let you reuse all of the work and the thought process that went into mm-hmm. that product tile or that, you know, shopping cart, or, you know, like we did a photo app that had some features that were like Photoshop editing on the web, right? Like whatever the thing is that you're designing, like when you're working with the design system, you have these reusable components. And a lot of design tools don't allow you to bring those pieces in. And so you end up with designers sort of replicating all of that in the tools. But there are a few actually that allow you to import design systems. It's really new, really, really new. But hopefully what we're seeing is the start of a shift, and maybe allowing us to sort of have those things integrate better, which would help.
Yeah. Maybe someone's listening can also develop one of these.
It would be nice.
Right. So, okay. So we talked a little bit about your designers can all code, and many of your developers went to art school or certainly have that design sensibility. So the pieces, and you touched briefly sort of on your process, but let's dig in on that and how the responsive design sprints, how they work at your organization and how sort of designers and development work together.
Yeah, sure. So I don't know that our process is tremendously different at the large from, you know, most design process, right? There's, you know, depending on the project, we might end up using personas. We might end up using, obviously doing some sort of discovery early on. We might have wireframes, like just kind of depends on what's necessary. But as soon as we can, we get into what we call a responsive design sprint, which is basically we do some discovery actually about the particular problem that we're trying to solve. So that could very well be, if we're trying to solve, say, a shopping cart on a site, or we're trying to solve a particular feature in a, you know, more complex product, software product, we're going to try to find out everything we can about how that's being used, all the features of it, all the edge cases, any existing information we have about that particular feature. And then we're going to do small screen sketching, because I know that mobile first has become a bit of a buzzword, but I prefer it from like the way that Luke Grabluski originally was talking about it, which is that it is a design constraint and it's a very helpful design constraint. If you have lived in a New York apartment and then moved to the suburbs, it's much easier than moving from the suburbs to a New York apartment. Design's the same way. So if we can make it work on a small screen, it's going to be easier to expand than it is to go the other way. So we'll do small screen sketches, and then usually we will immediately go into prototyping in the browser, building designs in the browser. And then we will share those designs as we're working on them, usually in Slack, a lot of animated GIFs sort of showing behavior and things of that nature. And once we sort of have that baked enough, then that cycle repeats. What'll happen is out of that, at some point we'll have maybe it's a full screen, maybe it's just a portion of an interface. We'll have something that we feel and the client feels is baked, right? It's ready to go. The code under that is going to be really bad. I mean, not bad, but it's not, it's not production ready code.
Right.
We're trying to move as fast as we can. Oftentimes when we're demoing stuff, we may say, this will only work in this browser at this point, because we're only testing in this. That's actually where oftentimes developers come in, is that they'll be taking portions of that design and then attempting to codify it. Okay, well now this particular piece, actually, you know, like if, like I use Product Tile for an example, that could be a card component, that could be some headings, that could be a button, like an image, a flexible embedded image. Like that ends up being like five or six different smaller components that they're extracting from the design and then going through and making sure that they're codifying how it gets used, all the variants of it, making sure that it's accessible, that it works cross-browser, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Those all get documented in the design system. And then they also feed into new designs. And then that process just repeats. And so for each design, as you're going through, you can do more and more complex things because you've got this richer and richher library of building blocks that you're building from.
Nice. I suppose it would be, you know, it's also a way to, you're continually determining feasibility, right? It's not a great idea. Oh, nope, can't do it, right? There's a continual look at that as well, which would speed the place to market. Do you have some examples of client projects that you can talk about?
Yeah. So we have, you know, some case studies that are on our site. I think I recently wrote about our process as part of like a series of articles that I'm writing about, you know, this problem of the tools that aren't really matched for today's problem set. Because I wanted to be able to talk about like why I'm even looking at this, like right. since it's not our problem or what I'm trying to get to. But in that article, probably my favorite example is actually what one of the things that happened for us on a project with Walmart, where we're working with Walmart's grocery site, and they were trying to make it responsive, and they had this interface that they called Book Slot. And Book Slot interfaces, I'm going to pick a particular time to either have food delivered to me or to go pick up my food. And the thing that we were handed originally was this, you know, fixed width seven, it was like this large table, 7 days, time slots, you know, like multiple time slots per day, and just a lot of information in it. And so the, you know, like from a pure design perspective, what you're trying to do is figure out, okay, well, what is the small screen version of this? How do we convey enough information so that somebody can, you know, there were things like, if you pick this time slot, it's more environmentally friendly because we'll already be in your neighborhood, you know, things of that nature. Like, how do we convey these complex concepts in a very small space? So we did that design work, you know, in this case, it was an HTML prototype, but it was essentially a flat prototype. Right, like you looked at it, and you could do some interactions with it, but it wasn't, you know, a small screen, the equivalent of like having a Photoshop mockup. Mm-hmm. But we had the benefit of having it on our phones, right? And so, you know, we picked it up and started playing with it, and you go to the end of the first day because you have 1 day of time slots. You get to the bottom of the first day, and you say, "Go to the next day." And it was really jarring. Like all of the, what was happening was that you might be going from a day that had say 20 slots to a day that had one or none. And so your screen and your page length suddenly shifted from a long page to an incredibly short page with no transition at all. And so you know, like now all of a sudden you're on a different area of the page. The page doesn't have as much room to scroll. Like what in the world just happened? And so I think you can say that the design was really good, but the experience was terrible.
Right.
And the experience on the device was terrible because of that, you know, like all the things that actually come from putting it in the web versus what the sort of, you know, flat design version of it would be. And so that gave us an opportunity to take the time to figure out, well, how do we orient people, right? So in this case, we needed to animate up the page. We needed to slide in the next screen. We needed to move the date slot over, you know, like also animate that. Each one of those animations had to have different timings and easings and stuff on them to actually make it intuitive. And it gets done and it just feels like the way that it should always work. But it, you know, like it wasn't intuitive. It wasn't the way that anyone thought it would go. And it wasn't something that we thought we would need to do until we actually experienced it. And that to me, I think is the real benefit of this sort of process is that you, because you're actually experiencing it, you identify things that you otherwise wouldn't even see.
I could see in a traditional model, there'd be a long time before you saw the problems that you were able
yes,
to see.
Yes, exactly.
Right? You'd go way down because everybody looks at the you know, the single mock-up and goes, it looks wonderful, beautiful, perfect, right? And then you don't see the issue for so much long. Yeah, that's great. It's a great example too. Yeah. And I've used the Walmart interface, so.
Well, good. I don't know how much of it still exists.
I know, that's always the fear. They could have changed it since then.
Yeah. But I feel like we did. I'll be surprised if they got rid of everything because we did some, I think, pretty foundational work there.
Great. So I know you mentioned the Commodore 64. So I have some idea of when you started here, and just the in your career and in your lifetime, the emergence of the web. Right. We talk about responsiveness and just really that conversation being, you know, the last dozen years or so. As someone who's seen just how much has evolved and how the places where we still want it to evolve. Like, how do you see the future, right? What do you think is coming in the perspective of what the web holds? And then how can designers listening, you know, be ready to adapt?
I think so the web is getting more capable all the time, which is the exciting part and probably the frustrating part for anyone who works in the medium. It is challenging to keep up with all of the pieces of it. I think from a design perspective, I cannot remember. I think it might have been Eric Meyer who made this point, but there somebody who I saw speak at an event apart had made the point that there's going to be a whole generation of people who never dealt with designs that were fixed width, who never sort of dealt with designs that used tables as layouts and all of the different things that we've done over the years to hack them, and really have only grown up with the current set of tools for doing designs and doing layout, which are amazingly powerful. Grid and Flexbox, but in particular Grid and the layouts that you can do. There, Jen Simmons has this whole sort of set of examples of her taking like magazine articles that have very non-traditional layouts and creating them with modern web tools. And so I feel like there's a real opportunity for people to do more exploration from the design side than I think we realize. We have now a lot of history in the traditional box designs that we have become accustomed to, right? Header across the top and all of those pieces. And so you don't want to break from convention just for the purposes of breaking from convention. But I also fear that sometimes we just don't realize what's available to us. So I feel like that's a piece of what's possible in the future. I think from on a more practical level, container queries, which is a particular bit of technology that makes design systems and components a lot more powerful. The fact that that is starting to ship into browsers, I think will cause us to, I think a lot of design in this space has moved a lot towards thinking about things as individual components, but we're still making modifications to those components based on like the size of the page as a whole. And container queries are like, okay, this, everything about this, basically we can now have a piece of a page that we've written all the rules for that are based on how much space you give it. And then you don't actually even have to know the space that it's ultimately going to be used at because you've taken care of, your rules are based on the space given that particular component versus the size of the page. And it seems like that's what we're doing right now, but we're not. We're using the size of the page as like a proxy for the size of the item in the page.
So you can see how this the little bit of difference there in all of the different variables could get extended, right? Could create much bigger problems than something like the container queries with the tightness that it would relate to would be much stronger.
Yeah. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that what this will mean is that, you know, if we're in this strange spot where we were working on a project recently and I realized we had design system components, we had web components, which is a web standards for doing components, we had JavaScript framework components like React or Ember or whatever, and then we had the components for the CMS. We had in this case it was Adobe Experience Manager components. And so we had components all the way down, but that at very rarely did the levels, were the components from one level able to talk to the other level, or be reused across levels. So like the other piece of this in my mind is like, if we are now spending a lot of time, like making sure that we're building things that are very resilient and have taken into consideration, accessibility and, different types of input. And we spend all the time on that. Like we want to be able to reuse it wherever we can, right? Like we want to be able to use that component in the different frameworks, in our CMSs and in our design tools, right? Like across the board. And so the last 3 years have been varying levels of experiments on my part to try to figure out like how far we can get towards that reality.
I love that.
It's encouraging, but it's not fully there yet.
Yeah. Well, and I love the view of the future because it's both really sharpening sort of the tech approach, the software, the place, helping us be smarter, but not necessarily always having to work harder, if that makes sense, right? It's being able to reuse and leverage. But also on the design side, to your point, we have lots of great standards, but looking at when we can push those, when we can think a little bit differently. I think the magazine one really hits home for us. We used to publish a magazine here. You know, we have an amazing art director, this award-winning print. And every time we translated it to the web, they look like blog posts to some degree, right? Like yeah. It just didn't have the same weight. And so it didn't have the same authority. And it's the struggle of the ease and readability and usage people want on the web and why they're going there, but still being able to leverage the design and maybe break the design functions in the right way. That is, I think, a space where we made some progress, but there's so much that can be done there that I love to see when someone really nails it. And especially if they can do it without making me move to an app. Right?
Yeah.
That's often the answer. Like, well, then you can do an app. I don't really want to download an app for for that one magazine. I want it to be here in my browser.
I mean, there are times where apps make sense, but there are a lot of times, and almost everybody who downloads an app will like and find out about the app through the web first. So right, yeah. First interaction that people have with web with most companies is through the web. And so, you know, like if you don't have a good experience there, then people won't download the app. The other thing, we were working with a company once who had an app. They were trying to convince people to download the app. They went to a store where people were lined up and they're like, hey, if you download this app and instead of being in this queue that you're in every payday, right, they were, you know, doing check cashing and things of that nature, doing money orders and sending money. So they come and do this at the store. Instead of being in this long queue, if you install this app and fill out the information in the app, then you can skip this long line and you can go over there to the other spot where there's nobody waiting because you've done all the work ahead of time. And, you know, like we want to encourage this. So they went into stores and said, we'll help you get on the bandwidth for our Wi-Fi for our store. We'll help you install the app, everything. And they heard from customers asking, like, can't I just do this on the web? I don't want to install another app. And, you know, part of this was that these were individuals who were lower income, either underbanked or unbanked individuals. And for them, they were on low end devices where storage was a problem. And so, you know, this company was asking them to install a 100 meg app as opposed to like having photos of their grandchildren or something.
Right.
Like that's a real trade-off that people are making. And I think when we're thinking about like, we just like casually decide to throw things to native applications, we're oftentimes forgetting that for wide portions of both the United States and across the world, like that actually is a barrier to entry and a place where they can't get access to it.
Yeah. It's always need to understand the persona and the environment and those choices and the trade-offs. Yeah. So one of the things that's, I'd say, really important, you know, one of the, I think the missions of Pragmatics Design Unit, one of the reasons we really got excited about this and some of the courses is we firmly believe in the strategic impact of design and the impact it can have when designers have and design has a seat at the table, right? And too many technology companies that we've worked with, too many non-tech companies, you know, I would say they're not always seeing that, you know, sometimes it's no, at the end we give it to the designers and, you know, they change the colors or whatever. And it's so different than when it's sort of an intrinsic part of the process and the thinking. So one of the things we always like to talk about with guests is sort of your advice for designers, someone that are new or someone at a company maybe where design isn't as integrated, advice for them when they're looking to be able to have a more strategic role and impact within the organization.
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes to being able to speak to the business case, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, if you are, and that doesn't even necessarily mean that you're speaking to the business case of design, but like, being able to understand the objectives, understand why the business is trying to do what it's going to do, being able to be fluent in those things and participate and contribute to those conversations helps you get to the point where you're involved in the conversations where those decisions are being made. And then being able to talk about you know, well, these are the pieces from design that we can help you, you know, validate these ideas, make sure that they're good ideas. Let's, you know, from our perspective, it would be a good opportunity to pitch, you know, low cost prototypes, things of that nature that allow you to validate that something will work. And I think that when you're, when you've got that broader business perspective in mind, that it becomes easier to participate in those conversations than if you're just trying to come to them with, okay, well, design really matters and you should be paying attention to it. Instead, it's like, I'm participating in the business conversation. I'm here for that entire conversation. Like, I'm a full participant. I'm somebody you want in the room because I understand what we're trying to accomplish and I'm bringing good ideas to the table. I'm going to save you money because I can look at it from a design perspective and here's some of the problems that I'm seeing and we should test these things and here's how we test them. So that's my best guess. I will say though, that a lot of the challenges you talk about are problems that come from, for individuals who are in larger organizations. And I've had 15 years of running a business where, design is at the core of what we do. I have a little less trouble convincing my my business partners and my coworkers that we should talk about design.
Yes, I was very fortunate when I joined Pragmatic as a person whose background is in product marketing. It's a company of product people, and so I was like, we need to go out and do market research. I was like ready to make the case like I did at other companies, right? Like, here's why we need the budget, here's why we need the time, and they were like, go. I was like, oh, right, yes, everybody gets it.
Exactly.
But I also think, 100% participating in those conversations, making a point to understand the business. And I think sometimes when we're really passionate about what we do, we know so much about it. And we know if we do this, it will have big, it will have implications. And we don't always help other people make those connections, right? Yeah. That this design work is going to deliver this business value because it's so obvious to us, right? It's not that we don't know. It's just like, well, of course everyone knows that and off you go. And you think, no, actually that's not true. And I think that's a big part of it as well. It's listening to the business. So you translate that to your own work, but then like explicitly calling out, like you'd said, so we're going to do a prototype here. That's actually going to save us time because it seems obvious to us, but to someone else, it could be like, oh, we're adding another step. Another step is prototypes. And you're like, no, right? But it's hard when we know it so much sometimes.
Yeah, it is tough. And particularly like when you see the end products where design didn't participate and you just want to cringe, right? Like I remember one of the early things in journalism was the idea that like you didn't want your name or your byline on something that you weren't proud of. And I feel the same way about the work we do whether that's design or development, but particularly on the design side, like I'm like, I cringe to think about the things that, that might go out the door that I don't want my name on that. If it doesn't have, exceptional design, doesn't have an exceptional experience.
Yeah. So. All right. We talked about lots of different stuff today, Jason. Mm-hmm. If you were going to have people do two things differently tomorrow, based on what we talked about today, what would it be?
So I think looking for ways to incorporate some sort of prototyping or, in the medium design. And my hope, so we didn't really talk about tools that much, but there are UXPin and Framer using a tool with Framer. There's, I forgot about the tool, but there is a tool, Interplay, is a name of it, third-party thing that actually allows for design system integration. And there's another tool that like allows Figma to have some breakpoints. So start to experiment in this way and look for ways to actually incorporate that sort of process into your organization. Like that would be the number one thing. And then we didn't talk about this, but I oftentimes look at the world and feel like I have a hammer and everything is a performance nail because I really, really, I feel like the speed of our experiences makes a big difference in how people perceive them. And too many web experiences are slow. Mm. Do whatever you can. Early on, we had this, I tried at a previous company, I tried to install a support system and people hated it. And they told me all these things that they needed to be done. And I collected all this feedback. And then I went and did two things. I made it so that it wasn't so ugly, right? It was open source software. So we had to spend a lot of time trying to make it not look so ugly. So we actually made it look like a nice system to interact with, and we made it fast. Mm. And the long list of other features we didn't touch, and we rolled it out, and people were like, this is great. The same people who argued previously and were like, you know, like these are all the showstopper issues they had were gone. So like performance makes a big difference. And I realize that's not a normal design consideration.
It's a good point though, right? It's sort of speed kills. It you can have the best looking design and a great outline experience, but if it hangs up, you just give up, right? Yeah. You're like, oh, must be broken. This is really frustrating. Yeah. I think it's a good reminder that that is a table stake that you can never forget.
And most websites, unfortunately, are doing poorly at that. So, so I realize that that's what we talked about, but if I had a second one, that was it.
I love it. Look for tooling, things that can help you there, and just never forget that speed matters.
Yeah.
Love it. All right, Jason, if people want to follow your work, where should we send them?
I think right now the main, I am on Twitter as Griggs and on LinkedIn as well. But right now, like a lot of the work that I'm doing is I'm writing a lot on Cloudflare's site. We've got I'm in the middle of a series of articles on exactly the stuff we're talking about. The next article is basically a deep dive into tools that have.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So if people are interested in that, that will be out there. And most of the series is out already.
Awesome. All right, Jason, it has been a pleasure. I appreciate you coming on and lending us your expertise and talking about all things with design with us.
Thank you very much.